Good evening. This is the KRFP Evening Report for Tuesday, August 13th, 2013. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Moscow Committee approves Joseph Street ball field agreement with Moscow School District. City councilors give okay to improve orphan paths around the city of Moscow. And Megalod protesters stop Omega Morgan load for 2 minutes in Missoula last night. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Fire crews say they were successful in conducting a burnout operation today to save the small mountain community of Pine from the Elk Complex fire, which has blackened nearly 140 square miles of forest around 100 miles east of Boise. Elk Complex Fire spokesperson Ludi Bond said the burnout to create a barrier free of combustible fuels between the fire and the community of Pine went along as planned. Bond said, with the weather in our favor and humidity going up and temperature decreasing, firefighters took advantage of that opportunity. Another burnout operation is being conducted today south of the massive elk fire at the Pony Complex, which has scorched close to 225 square miles so far. The fire is approximately 35% contained, but firefighting efforts are complicated by downed power lines. The communities of Pine and Featherville are now under mandatory evacuation orders issued yesterday. Elmore County Sheriff deputies were going door to door in an effort to rouse area families and alert residents to clear out. Some residents have chosen to remain in their homes despite the disapproval of local officials. Pine resident Butch Glineski said he was available to help as he set up protective measures around his property in Pine. He said, "As much as they say we need to be out, I think we can always offer something. It's just, you know, the area." Boise National Forest District Ranger Stephanie Church said, "People have a false sense of security. We can't do our job when they refuse to leave and they're diverting resources." The elk fire has moved much faster this year than the massive fire in the same area last year, indicating far less moisture in trees that are in the ravines and brushy ridges where the fire is sweeping through. Church said everything is behaving like it has no moisture at all. Church added the fire has destroyed several homes, but an exact count has not been determined. Idaho Fish and Game Warden Jeff Day said he saw several cabins destroyed by the fire at Fall Creek, which is a popular camping and fishing spot, though the resort at Fall Creek itself was still standing. All residents had gotten out by the time the fire arrived. In Idaho County, the Myrtle Fire, which has burned over 300 acres, was on pace to be fully contained by sometime this morning. Nez Perce Tribe Fire Management Officer Jeff Handel said, "We are winning the battle." With full containment near, Handel said the fire will burn and smolder for several weeks before running out of fuel. Several Cottonwood Creek homes were threatened but were saved by fire crews. Handel said, "Our objective is to basically do what we call mop up the edges for about 150 feet all around the fire." State Department of Land's public relations officer in Craigmont, Regina Mundell, said crews continued to work on the 8-acre Boggs fire near Winchester, and the Cottonwood Creek fire held steady at 166 acres. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. Moscow City Supervisor Gary Riedner told city council members at yesterday's administrative committee meeting work on the Joseph Street ball fields could move quickly once the joint agreement between the city and the Moscow School District is approved. Riedner outlined next steps that could take place soon after the full city council and the school board approve the agreement. That was before the city's administrative committee yesterday afternoon. Here's City Supervisor Gary Riedner.
"One of the first things that needs to be done is to work with the public. The public's had a lot of input into this project from its inception, dating back to 1999 with some of the preliminary plans. And again, work that's been done within the last 2 years with the district's facilities planning committee and discussions that the city has had throughout this process as well. With that in mind, once a design professional, an architect, is identified and retained, one of the first things that that architect will do is begin working with representatives mm-hmm. of the public, interest groups, whatever you want to call them, on a design planning team. The idea is to see if the plans that have been done up till now are sufficiently reflective of the public's wants so that we can move ahead in a pretty quick fashion, or whether we want to go back and start over. Of course, we're hoping, and because of all the work that's been done up to now, we hope that we just build on those strides that we've taken up till now. That is a very, very short committee, and I'll just plug some time frames in while we're at it.
That was the question.
Well, the first time frame is this is coming to you today. Walter Steed is the council member who's been serving on the ARC up till now. Jim Frenzel from the school district board is serving on behalf of the school district. We put this together. We drafted it. We've gone over it. You're seeing it today. It will come to you next Monday. And if the council agrees with it, signs off on it, it will then be sent to the school district for consideration at their meeting on August 27th. So pretty quick turnaround. This has been vetted out by all the members of the ARC as well as the attorneys involved. And I just talked to Ron Landeck this morning. He's on his way to take his daughter back to college. So he gave me a call from Billings, Montana. He's got a couple of little changes that you can see mostly have to do with some qualifying language, but nothing that changes the agreement at all.
That was Moscow City Supervisor Gary Riedner at yesterday's Moscow City Council Administrative Committee meeting. The city and the school district plan on contributing $1.5 million each to the project. The city's share comes from the Hamilton Estate Fund for Youth Recreation. The agreement requires the city and the school district to share maintenance costs for up to 30 years. Riedner further outlined how the construction process would work.
Once that architect is selected, it'll take some time to put a contract together, but we are hoping that we can begin this process in early October, if not near October 1st, a very aggressive timeline. The process for working through a site concept plan and putting getting public input, opportunity for input, will be a fairly short turnaround. And we're hoping to get that done by no later than December 1st. So about 60 days, maybe a little over, a little less, to get that input, find out if we have sufficient consensus on behalf of the community, the council, and the board to say go ahead. If that can be done in that quick time frame, then we will be able to have the architect finish up design and prepare bid specs and get the documents ready for bid. Our hope is that we can go out to bid sometime the end of January or at the very latest the end of February. That's the prime bid time, knowing that that property being fairly lowland and floodplain in some areas, you won't be able to get on and really work it until probably around the middle of May or June. So we're hoping for a construction season or a construction date somewhere around June, anticipating what people pretty much agree will be a summer of 2014 construction season, that if we can have the construction completed by, say, October, or somewhere around there, that it can be ready for at least some sort of play during the 2015 season. Again, as I said, it's an aggressive timeline, and it may very well be weather dictates. Contractors may not be available. Architects may not be able to respond as quickly, so on and so forth. But unless we have some targets, we anticipate we will be a year farther out than if we try to do this as quickly as we can. So you have the basic timeline now. And I think I've gone through most of the responsibilities. We wanted to make sure that, again, the council and the board have the ultimate responsibility for approvals and that the school district will be carrying the budget on this. We have a process set up for when bills come in. They will go to the school district. They will be vetted and approved by the ARC, and then they will be forwarded under the contract to the city for payment.
That was Moscow City Supervisor Gary Riedner. In other business yesterday, the Administrative Committee heard from Paradise Path Task Force Chair Margaret Littlejohn on a proposal from the task force to make minor improvements to what they call orphan paths around the city. The task force says there are several orphan paths, which are short pieces of public access corridors owned by the city. Most of the pieces of land are unimproved sections of right-of-way with no signs and mostly include a footpath worn into the ground. Here's Margaret Littlejohn.
Our overall suggestions are that we sign these short pathways as a public pathway so that residents know they are available for use, and also make some minor improvements such as adding gravel or bark just so that the surface is not mud in the winter. And also we are, as task force members, willing to help make this happen by doing physical labor. So we have four sections of pathway that we're interested in getting approval for to move forward. And the first one is at Van Buren, a dead end between E and Morton Street. And it's currently used by walkers, but I'm not sure if everybody knows it is a public pathway. There's some barricades that come in from the sides at the end of the street, and there's an opening, as you can see in that upper left picture, where people can walk through. But it is not signed in any way, and it is currently used by walkers, and we would like to see it get signed, and I don't think maybe it even needs any improvements other than that, signed at both ends. The second one is near the Jim Lyle Rotary Park, and it's between Garfield Street and Vandal Drive. And you see the orange arrow up there at the top of the map, which is identifying that little trail. Again, a dead end on Vandal Drive, and the pathway goes down to Garfield Street. And a few photos of that pathway show you the situation there, looking in the upper left from Vandal Drive down toward Garfield Street. It's just a dirt pathway, and there is a standpipe there and a kind of a little sinkhole next to it that we might need to do something about just to make sure people don't run into that. But it would be nice to sign both ends of that. Currently, there is no identification that it's a public pathway on either end. So we're just looking for the opportunity to improve that short pathway. The third one is Peachtree Drive and Virginia Avenue. And the map on the far right there shows the route of the pathway. On the southern end of that map, you can see the right angle where the pathway is actually a concrete sidewalk that goes around a person's property, and then the rest of it is all just a dirt pathway that goes near some trees. And we're again looking for the permission to sign it on both ends so that people know it is usable to get between those two streets. And right now the Peachtree end looks like it's somebody's property almost. So you don't know whether you should go up it or not. So again, we would just like to maybe make some minor improvements on the dirt end of that and sign both ends. And the final one is Mountain View connection to Satuna Street. So right now that is scheduled to be made into a street at some point, but I don't know when it will happen. But it is used by walkers and bikers, and I guess in the winter even for snow activities. But we would simply like to, again, make the trail somewhat improved by adding either bark or gravel and signing both ends. And I have a few photos of that view. Right now there is a sidewalk that ends on Mountain View, and there's a couple of barricades there where people can walk through and go down the slope and then come up on Satuna. The upper left photo is the Satuna end, and as you see, there are no signs of any kind on either end to identify it as a public pathway. And again, we would just like to add some bark or gravel to make it a little less muddy when it is wet, and sign both ends as a public pathway. So those are the four locations, and again, we just want to sign them and make some minor improvements, nothing permanent.
That was Paradise Path Task Force Chair Margaret Littlejohn at yesterday's Moscow City Council Administrative Committee meeting. Councilmember Wayne Krause said the city should make sure the signs are seen as invitations for the city to assume liability for injuries on the steeper terrain that some of the orphan paths have. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow. About 25 activists with Northern Rockies Rising Tide blocked the tar sands-bound Omega Morgan Megalode on Reserve Street in Missoula last night. Montana Highway Patrol officers ordered those who stepped in front of the 644,000-pound tar sands shipment off the road, and they complied. After about 2 minutes, there were no arrests. The load continued to a truck stop at Bonner, east of Missoula, before stopping for the day today. Up to 40 Montana activists converged on Reserve Street Sunday night to protest the tar sand shipment, but the load stayed put just inside Montana on Lolo Pass. Observers said the megaload wastewater evaporator owned by General Electric would likely move today instead. Steve Shoresman of the Missoula-based group Northern Rockies Rising Tide told the Missoulian newspaper most of the protesters were from the Confederated Salish and Kootenai and Blackfeet tribes. Shoresman said, "We're doing it largely to show solidarity with the Nez Perce Nation and what they're standing up for." Although Shoresman said Northern Rockies Rising Tide does not have an active campaign against the shipments hauler Omega Morgan wants to bring through Idaho and Montana, he said the group wants to bring energy and awareness to the general upswing of climate activism across the nation. "We're not targeting this specific company. We're just getting people fired up about all this stuff." The Calgary Herald reported the load will be owned by Athabasca Oil Company as soon as it arrives at their tar sands site in northeastern Alberta. Specifically, the megaload is destined for Athabasca's Hanging Stone project in the tar sands. The paper quoted Athabasca Vice President of Projects and Thermal Operations, Rick Koshman, saying the delays caused by the Nez Perce tribal blockades in Idaho were not a concern to the company. Idaho Rivers United and the Nez Perce tribe late last week filed a lawsuit against the Forest Service for not enforcing its authority to stop megaloads from traveling through tribal treaty rights areas and the Wild and Scenic River Corridor along the Lacsaw and Middle Fork Clearwater Rivers. Koshman said he could not comment on how the lawsuit might impact Athabasca's operations or the second tar sands megaload already shipped up the Columbia but now sitting at the port of Wilma near Clarkston, Washington. In 2011, ExxonMobil's Canadian subsidiary Imperial Oil changed plans to transport more than 200 tar sands modules on U.S. Highway 12 in Idaho due to legal pressure resulting from grassroots opposition. The oil giant instead split those loads in half so they could fit under highway overpasses on Interstates 90 and 15 on their way to Alberta. ExxonMobil said shipment issues were the biggest factor that increased the cost of their tar sands project from $10.9 billion to $12.9 billion. BMO Capital Markets analyst Jared Ziuba told the Calgary Herald companies working in the Alberta tar sands increasingly want to import giant modules for their projects because of labor shortages in Alberta, which would make it more expensive to manufacture the modules there. Ziuba said the trade-off is that sometimes producers run into logistical challenges. This is not new, and I suspect it will continue. The General Electric load being hauled by Omega Morgan through Montana is required to pull over every 10 minutes to let traffic by at times when there is traffic behind them. The state of Montana does not let megaloads travel on Friday or Saturday nights. New details emerged yesterday in the abduction of 16-year-old Hannah Anderson of San Diego, who was rescued Sunday while camping with her abductor in Idaho's Frank Church of River of No Return Wilderness. San Diego County Sheriff Bill Gore said the suspect fired at least one and possibly two rifle shots on FBI agents before they returned fire, killing him. Additionally, according to Gore, Hannah Anderson did not know her mother and brother were dead as a result of DiMaggio's previous actions in San Diego. Anderson was abducted by 40-year-old James Lee DiMaggio after he allegedly killed Anderson's mother and 8-year-old brother. Gore said, quote, "I can't make it any clearer. She was a victim in this case. She was not a willing participant." Gore spoke at a press conference with the girl's father, Brett Anderson. Brett Anderson said his daughter went through a horrific ordeal and that she is in for a slow recovery. Anderson thanked all involved with his daughter's safe return, especially the horse riders who first spoke to the two California residents near an alpine lake, and said the search might have taken longer if not for them. He also asked for privacy for Hannah and his family.